You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
As a candidate, Trump took quite a friendly tone with America's oldest enemy, well, not oldest enemy, but most significant enemy, Russia. But of course, as president, his foreign policy has pursued a very more traditional, especially Republican path, which reflects around a century of rivalry between the two countries in which both built up a system of alliances around the world. Of course, under the Tsars, which was the kings of Russia, it had always been seen as vastly different to America, quite backwards. Whether or not that's true, America had slaves until the 1860s, it had serfdom until the mid-20th century, Jim Crow. But of course, it's not about reality, it's about the perception. But anyway, then when you had the Bolshevik Revolution, then you had the creation of the Soviet Union, which became America's polar opposite and then primary enemy throughout the 20th century. So the following we've got up next is just a quick newsreel footage of American soldiers going to fight against the Bolsheviks in Russia's civil war.
It's 1917, and from San Francisco, American troops set sail for Siberia to reinforce Tsarist troops fighting steadily losing civil war with Bolshevist insurgents. Even in 1917, Red Menace took armed Americans across the Pacific to fight a war. With seasoned troops goes large shipment of arms. War internal struggle in Russia and Siberia looked like long affair in 1917, though no one was betting on the Bolshevists to win. With brother doughboys busy with a fight in France, these fellows went off to war in the frozen wastes of Siberia. Several years later, same troops come home on transport Mazakaska with not much war behind them. Instead, they return with their Russian war brides and half-Russian children. The Reds won Russia and Siberia from the Tsar, but these Russians won happiness and the hearts of American men.
Yes, so after World War I, which was all this taking place, America became the predominant power in an imperial system established by countries such as Britain and France, who were themselves still reeling from World War I, which America participated in, but to a much lesser extent. So it became America's role to suppress local movements demanding national autonomy, who then desperately sought an enemy of their enemy. Meanwhile, of course, Russia was, interrupted by periods of famine and war, rapidly modernizing, and by the end of World War II, was the leading contender to America's place as predominant superpower.
The Soviet Union has progressed from a war-ravaged nation with a military capability greatly inferior to that of the United States, to a point where it has achieved a rough strategic parity with us and is now striving for military superiority.
President Truman's dramatic announcement that Russia has created an atomic explosion sends reporters racing for Flushing Meadow, where Russia's Vyshinsky arrives to address the United Nations. Leaders of the communist world meet in Warsaw to sign the treaty, which is their answer to NATO. The Soviet Premier Bulganin is prominent on the platform when the delegates show themselves to Warsaw's thousands. Bulganin answers the question all are asking: who is to be GOC of the joint forces of Russia, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Bulgaria, Romania, and Albania?
Marshal Советского Союза, товарищ Конев.
It is Marshal Konev, much decorated veteran of the Second World War. Since Sputnik began going round the world at 5 miles a second, the Russian man in the street has been on top of the world. American concern at this inescapable proof of Soviet technical progress was as great as Russian pride. In both cases, quite understandable. A reminder of a truth that many in the West have been reluctant to realize, that with her steadily expanding resources, Russia is a growing technical power in her own right. Of course, Russian engineers and scientists are proud of their growing strength, but the world is less happy. In the turbulent waters of modern politics, what matters is how strength is used. And the news from the Middle East, where oil isn't the only thing that's inflammable, suggests that Russia's leaders, having impressed the world, are now trying to frighten it. Posing as the champion of the Arab peoples, the Kremlin produces a scare that has all the hallmarks of a manufactured crisis. Syria, the Kremlin declares, is being threatened. Turkey's army, according to Khrushchev, is preparing to cross the Syrian border. And if it does, Russia will hit back.
Yes, so as you heard there, Syria, along with Egypt, was part of the Russian alliance against US-backed countries such as Jordan, Iraq, and Israel.
The Kremlin, in 1958, took the initiative in the global power struggle. Khrushchev's wooing of Gamal Abdel Nasser brought new upheavals in the Middle East. Strengthened by Soviet arms and economic aid, Nasser began the year by joining Egypt and Syria into the new United Arab Republic. Pan-Arabism was on the march. Nasser was his prophet, and there was dire peril for friends of the West.
At Amman, Jordan, native troops, United States Ambassador Lester Mallory, and Jordanian officials await the start of Operation Equalizer in the Middle East. The first transfusion of U.S. arms designed to counteract the Russian buildup in Syria. Jeeps with tank-killing recoilless rifles.
The six-day Middle East war echoes along a second front, the diplomatic struggle at the United Nations Security Council. A series of emotionally charged meetings keeps delegates debating on nearly around-the-clock basis. Syrian Ambassador George Tomei charges Israel with continued ceasefire violations. Soviet delegate Nikolai Fedorenko heaps abuse and lashing invective on both Israel and the United States. In a blistering filibuster, Russia breaks diplomatic relations with Israel and threatens sanctions.
Of course, closer to home for Americans were the events surrounding the Cuban Missile Crisis, which took place shortly after the rise of Fidel Castro and a failed coup attempt against him in the Bay of Pigs.
The assault has begun on the dictatorship of Fidel Castro. Cuban army pilots opened the first phase of organized revolt with bombing raids on three military bases. Two of the B-26 light bombers then seek asylum in Florida. On the heels of the air raids, landings were effected by rebels at several places on the Cuban coast, and the rebellion against the red-tinged dictator was on.
Peasant farmers marking the second anniversary of Cuba's agrarian reform law hear an extraordinary announcement by Castro. A ransom bid smacking of his Russian communist masters and the days of the Nazis. He offers to trade 1,200 rebels captured in the abortive Cuban invasion for 500 tractors and sends 10 PWs to the U.S. to negotiate.
On October 22, 1962, President John F. Kennedy broadcast a special message to the nation from his office in the White House. Here is President Kennedy as he delivered that message bearing on recent events in Cuba.
A series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere.
As expected, the American Embassy in London was the target of two factions, the pro-Russians, who were always good for a knock at the Americans, and the ban the bomb people. When they sat down to reinforce the argument, they were removed. Busy time for the police. Meanwhile, the naval blockade against Russian and satellite ships nearing Cuba was put into effect. At the White House, making the announcement to the waiting world, Mr. Kennedy said that only a few days before, Foreign Minister Gromyko falsely assured him that Russia had put no rockets on Cuba. Photographic proof to the contrary was soon in the president's hand. Castro long ago chose to ally his government with Russia, a course he may regret. He made his allegiance clear at the United Nations 2 years ago. The Russian leader played up as only he can. But as we go to press, it is announced that he will suspend shipments of arms to Cuba. Kennedy has spoken and acted in the way the Soviet understands. Russians turned out in thousands to show the world, and America in particular, that Nikki loves Fidel. President Castro had the red carpet treatment all the way to the Red Square. Castro, of course, didn't at all like the Russians having to take their rockets away from Cuba.
So Khrushchev invited him to Moscow to meet the best friends he has outside his own countrymen.
Yes, so all of this, of course, means that it's very hard, perhaps even impossible, for America and Russia to get along just because there's so much baggage. And this creates, of course, a lot of tension between the two, which is most apparent in the coverage of world events by media outlets Russia Today and Fox News, who more or less represent the ideology of each country's ruling party. For example, take Fox News' coverage of a gas attack in Syria and subsequent American missile strike on a government airbase.
Very bold, decisive move by President Trump, and one that some critics are saying is not in accord with prior statements that he has made.
Which I think is fine.
The president sending a pointed message to punish Assad. President Donald Trump denouncing the gruesome gas attack.
Your reaction to the president pulling the trigger last night?
Donald Trump comes in and, you know, he took swift, decisive action, and it made Americans proud. I think it made people all around the world proud.
I feel like what President Trump did last night was put America back on the geopolitical map.
This was a brilliant strike. It was precise. It was proportional.
President Trump proved why I voted for President Trump and why a lot of people ended up voting for President Trump.
We finally have a man who knows the difference between right and wrong and good and evil, and it makes us proud, finally.
In comparison, Russia Today took a generally pro-government line.
It was not the Syrian government who did this, because we didn't do it, and we know that we didn't do it.
Added that the Syrian army does not have any chemical weapons at the moment.
Hasn't been any investigation or official judgment.
It's presented as a fait accompli, isn't it, that Bashar al-Assad was behind this?
I don't think the evidence is there.
Evidence propagated by terrorists. One of them are the White Helmets, an arm of al-Qaeda. Why would we take the word of terrorists who murdered 3,000 Americans on 9/11.
Governor of the Homs province who spoke to us and says that Islamic State's now launched an offensive in that area following those U.S. airstrikes this morning.
This is direct support for terrorists in this region.
They are masters at staging deceptive operations.
They are fighting against extreme radical terrorist groups. The future of Syria is at stake.
The disparity between the two is also displayed in the coverage of disputed elections in Venezuela.
President Nicolas Maduro's outrageous power grab.
Over 100 people have been killed by Maduro's thugs.
Venezuela on the brink. The chaos in Caracas.
Some people think already, some analysts, that the country's going to fall by October this year.
Cannot buy the basic necessities of a civilized life.
GDP dropped 12% in 2016.
It's a socialist government and a criminal government in some ways.
Can they stop the socialist government from completely crippling the country?
Wiping out the National Assembly, their Congress, and replacing it with a Cuban-style government.
Having communism stuffed down their throats.
Why does this matter to the United States? Number one, thousands of asylum seekers. Number two, it's our values and it's in our hemisphere. You could see it spread to Colombia, Honduras, Guatemala, Nicaragua, it's already there, El Salvador, and ultimately into Mexico and right to the U.S. border.
I spent some time in the Orinoco region where they have these amazing oil reserves, but it's thick, heavy tar that needs the technology of foreign companies that can go in there and help them to refine all this stuff. Well, what did they do? They kicked all the foreign companies out.
Yes, so as in Syria, Fox News supports the pro-American rebel forces.
Sanctions on Venezuela's oil industry would not be without cost for Washington. A Latin American country is the third largest exporter of crude oil to the U.S.
The U.S. government needs to stop cheerleading, funding, and doing everything it can to topple the government.
RT's been speaking exclusively with the Venezuelan president.
I think the opposition has been doing this for 18 years, first against Hugo Chavez, and for the past 4 years against me. I think it's insane for the extreme right in the U.S. to be talking of a blockade against Venezuela.
Despite the fact that Maduro was democratically elected, U.S. leaders call him a dictator.
A political TV show reporter has been threatened over her coverage of anti-government protests in Venezuela last month.
The vast majority of the violence and deaths have been caused directly or indirectly from the opposition forces. It's very dangerous to be a state journalist on the ground there. And I don't see a peep from Human Rights Watch, from international human rights organizations. They do not want their narrative to be punctured, and they will do anything to keep a wrap on that. And unfortunately, the Western press just goes along with it.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.